here's a story from The World.
Okay, all fall we've been taking deep dives into China's economic transformation over the past two decades, changes that have had huge reverberations worldwide. We've been examining these impacts thanks to a reporting project called On China's New Silk Road. It's focused on how China has leveraged its economic and technological power from Latin America to Europe. In Asia, though, there are two centers of power, China and India. It's a rivalry that turned into a military conflict this year. Mary Kay Magstad reports.
Buddhism, born in India, traveled to China on the ancient Silk Road. Those trade routes go back more than 2,000 years. They connected the region and ran all the way to Europe. Some Buddhist pilgrims traveled through Ladakh. It's a Himalayan region that borders both northern India and China's western edge, where Tibet and Xinjiang meet. And Ladakh is one of three parts of the bigger region of Kashmir. There's Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir, Pakistan-controlled Azad Kashmir, with tensions between India and Pakistan over those areas. And then there's Ladakh, administered by India and bordering China. But that border has never been demarcated, and it's hotly contested. India and China fought a war there in 1962, with China seizing a chunk of land a bit smaller than Rhode Island, and then building a road within it to connect the Chinese territories of Xinjiang and Tibet. In summer 2020, conflict at that line of control erupted again. Chinese troops pushed forward, and Indian troops pushed back. This sound from a video in June 2020, released by the South China Morning Post, is of a tight scrum with Chinese and Indians beating each other, some with sticks. There's been a long-standing agreement not to use gunfire at that line of control. 20 Indian soldiers died, and China took casualties too, though it hasn't said how many. Since then, each side has moved tens of thousands of troops, standing off at high altitude as winter sets in. In New Delhi, down a dusty lane with juice vendors and stray dogs in a tranquil Ladakh Buddhist temple, Ladakh native Punsak Angchuk has feelings about what China's doing.
It always says that Ladakh is a part of China, but it is actually not a part of China. Ladakh was an independent country for many years.
So in other words, you're concerned that maybe China would try to have more influence in Ladakh?
Yeah, it will try.
It's already trying, he says, with China's Belt and Road Initiative, one of the world's most ambitious infrastructure projects. India is not part of it. That's a conscious choice due to security concerns and to a desire for India not to be drawn into a network that China controls. But India's neighbor Pakistan has joined the Belt and Road, and it's home to one of the initiative's biggest projects, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It includes roads, a railway project, dams, and more, and it runs from China southwest through Ladakh and through that contested part of Kashmir that Pakistan occupies and India says is rightfully its own.
Because China is always trying to dominate the whole region, the whole Asia. That's how they're trying to just dominate India through, trying to surround India through that route also. We are not in favor of that route.
China has one vision of how the Asian century will play out, with China as the center of a hub-and-spokes network, as the top power in Asia and perhaps in the world. India is not on board with that, and it's looking for ways to counter China's ambitions with its own vision of a more multipolar Asia and world. So, all of this three-dimensional chess is going on between China and India in Pakistan and in the region. And some Indian strategists see China trying to encircle India, in Pakistan to India's north and west, in Myanmar to India's east with a Chinese-built port, and in Sri Lanka to India's south, where China now has a 99-year lease of the port of Hambantota. Back in India's capital, New Delhi, Major General Dhruv Katosh says India needs to be vigilant and prepared.
I think what India will have to do is to maintain a strong fleet. We have to increase the capacity of our Navy. As of now, it's quite all right. We have to increase the capacity of our Navy to match what Chinese can do in the future.
The United States has been happy to play a role here. It held a joint U.S.-Indian naval exercise just weeks after Chinese and Indian troops clashed at the border, as this India Today report laid out.
In a big message to China, the American Navy ship USS Nimitz Carrier Battle Group is conducting a passage exercise with Indian Navy's frontline ships near the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Indian Ocean. Now, this is a huge show of strength and faith.
The ships are shown cruising through open seas. They went toward what for China is the strategically vital Malacca Strait, through which much of China's imported oil from the Middle East and Africa passes. This display backed up what President Trump told a stadium full of Indians when he visited New Delhi in February 2020.
America loves India, America respects India, and America will always be faithful and loyal friends to the Indian people.
The U.S. government has also been working with India, Australia, and Japan in something called the Quad, because there are four of them. They focus on security, but also in offering the Asia-Pacific region and beyond other options for infrastructure projects than just taking money from China on China's terms. And at a well-heeled club in Delhi, a former Indian foreign secretary, Shyam Saran, tells me India should play to its strengths.
We have had a history of investing in education in Africa. We have had a history of offering Africa assistance in things like, you know, medium and small scale industries, entrepreneurship. China has been much more extractive. Investment has been much more extractive, not so much India. And I think on balance, rather than try to compete with China, you know, if China has done a stadium, then we must also run and do a stadium. Or if China has invested something here, then we should also do the same. I think rather than doing that, really try to leverage precisely the areas of strength that we have.
Like, India is really good at making high-quality, low-cost pharmaceuticals, many of which have gone to Africa. By contrast, Chinese companies have in the past been called out for supplying Africa with lower quality, sometimes fake or unsafe, pharmaceuticals. But if India is going to provide the region and the world with alternatives to China, it's got a heavy lift on some fronts, because it has challenges China no longer does. More than a quarter of India's population still lives in poverty, compared to China's 1.7%. More than 20% of Indians are illiterate, compared to 4% of Chinese. Just one-third of Indians live in cities, where ideas and innovations spread more quickly, compared to 60% of Chinese. And rural areas in India tend to be poor and underserved. So when it comes to a head-to-head competition with China in the world, not all Indians think it's going to be a slam dunk anytime soon, even when it comes to monetizing India's strengths.
My whole concern is whether Indian companies will do this or simply buy and sell Chinese products.
This is Saibal Dasgupta. He's a correspondent for the Times of India in Beijing. We overlap there, and he's author of the book Running with the Dragon, How India Should Do Business with China. We caught up in New Delhi at his book launch at the Foreign Correspondents Club of South Asia, where samosas and other savory snacks were served on the grassy front lawn. And we caught up later for a quieter chat.
So Indians, Indian companies, Indian firms have those capabilities. It's a question of, do you have fire in your stomach? You know, like in sports, Indians are supposed to be lacking the fire in the stomach. They're not fighters. They're great talkers, great debaters. But can they put their head down and fight it out?
Well, in Silicon Valley, they do it. I mean, you know, a huge number of startups are done by Indian immigrants to the U.S.
If you go to places in California, you see Indians not only doing business, but doing the most innovative part of the business. Artificial intelligence is researched by Indian scientists in American universities and replicated in China.
So, great, he says. China sees the value of what Indian researchers are doing, But why don't Indian entrepreneurs hit the market with such technologies before China does? Why isn't India exporting its innovations around the world the way China did over 30 years to create what many hail as a miracle of economic growth?
But I have always thought that the miracle is an overstated story. It was never a miracle. It was a miracle because the world was foolish enough not to grab opportunities. And India was particularly responsible for Chinese miracle, because India was not doing those things that it could have done with the same factories, with the same energy, with the same capability, with the same bad infrastructure.
Saibal argues that it takes vision and drive to make that happen, and India's leaders could use more of both. Former Foreign Secretary Shyam Saran agrees that India's government could and should do more to incentivize more Indian companies to become more globally competitive.
I mean, there is a lot of innovation taking place. I mean, this is a big startup culture now here. A lot of young entrepreneurs, you know, who are in their 30s and who are coming up with great solutions to problems that we face. I don't think that is an issue. I think the issue really here in India is how do you create an ecosystem where there can be very rapid commercialization of the innovations that you are coming up with. You know, that ecosystem is still, I would say, somewhat weak. And that depends a great deal on government policy. It depends a great deal on what kind of incentives, what kind of regulatory regime the state has in place. And in that respect, I think China has created an ecosystem which has enabled companies which may have started small but are now big multinationals. That is the way to go.
A small example of how that might work is playing out at the Indian Institute of Technology in New Delhi. It's kind of like the MIT of India. And in one of its buildings, I'm heading to a lab sponsored by Ericsson, experimenting with ways to use 5G.
It's extremely important for India to not be left very, very far behind the rest of the world as far as evolution of communication technology is concerned.
This is Brijesh Lal. He heads this 5G Center of Excellence and the School here of Telecom Technology and Management. He says on this front, India has a lot of catching up to do.
As far as 2G, 3G, and 4G are concerned, India had almost no role to play.
Because
when you are this constrained for resources, then at times it becomes difficult to contribute to the technology. So even though you have a large volume, but you don't have enough financial clout to be able to contribute to the development. The other area that's important is that we might be a very, very large market, but the market is not a very aware market. As a consumer, we do not pressure our service provider to improve the technology.
And that means that despite the head start India once had over China in tech, it is not in a position now to install its own 5G at home, much less export it abroad. Here in this lab, engineers are working to change that.
We had a pre-release 5G setup here, and finally now we have a release-compliant 5G setup down in the lab, the testbed that we have in the Center of Excellence. There was a driverless car, a first of its kind in the country, happened out of this lab. So that created a lot of interest, a lot of buzz. So now people know what 5G is about. So this is about getting people interested. It's about people contributing. It's about people making an effort to make India a player.
Perhaps by the time 6G rolls around, in what Brijesh Lal guesses will be 5 to 10 years, because 6G relies more on software than hardware, and software is the Indian tech sector's power alley. Another point that has long been in India's favor is that it has been a tolerant, multicultural, secular democracy with free speech and free assembly. That's been eroded by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist policies, including a Citizenship Act, amended in December 2019, that could take rights away from millions of Muslims in India. And in the New Delhi newsroom of an online news organization called NewsClick, editor Prabir Purkayastha says, through this widespread support of Hindu nationalist policies, India is squandering one of its greatest assets, a diverse generation of smart, engaged young people, like the ones pounding the phones in this newsroom.
Let's put it this way. India, I think, had an enormous advantage in that it had conceived of itself as a country coming out of colonialism, which did not base its nationhood on ethnicity, language, race, any of these things. It was an inclusive nation. And in that sense, I would say what European Union was trying, India had actually reached well before that as a part of the anti-colonial struggle.
He says being inclusive helped spur India's economic growth over the past couple of decades.
So it gave us a very large economy. And of course, people is the key resource base. And after having spent a huge effort in building a nation of this kind, we're at the moment in complete reverse gear and abandoning all the gains that we have made, all the things that we could value as what makes India different, young people, forward-looking society. We're now backward, looking back, looking at divisions and how to set one set of people against another and how to justify the nationhood on the basis of an internal enemy and an external enemy. Pakistan is the external enemy, internal enemy being the Muslims.
India has long been the other Asian giant, influential in many ways over millennia. The question now, in the face of China's ambition and India's current direction, is what kind of nation India wants to be at home and in the world, and whether India will decide to lead by example in a direction in which others want to follow.
Mary Kay Magstad reporting for the Project on China's New Silk Road, a podcast from the Global Reporting Center. Thanks to journalists Saibal Dasgupta and Taha Siddiqui for their work on this story. You can hear the entire series on China's New Silk Road wherever you listen to podcasts.